podcast this week, I get 1 degree closer to Kevin Bacon by interviewing Kevin Bacon, star of You Should Have Left, plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is glad that we're going into Tier 2 lockdown just ahead of Halloween, because nothing, folks, will deter Michael Myers more than a curfew. Haha, didn't think of that, Myers, did you? Stymied.
Tomorrow we do Halloween.
Nope.
Halloween.
Stop this.
And this podcast.
This ends now. This ends now. No more Silver Shamrock. Never.
No, absolutely not.
Chris, you've seen what happens in Halloween, right? This is a glimpse into your future.
Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which ends with Tom Atkins screaming, "Stop it." And that's what I intend to get you guys to do to me. That sounded weird and sexual.
Good but, Lord.
It's not. Anyway, hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Emperor Podcast. This week, I am joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning, but also lethal unpreparedness, which means that the three-fact structure, which I was going to bring back this week, was apparently news to my three colleagues of such lethal cunning, so they have asked for it to be delayed until next week. Anyway.
Well, we've tried the filibuster to get rid of it. Now we're just trying with flat-out gaslighting.
It's unkillable. It's like Jason Voorhees. Anyway, please welcome our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Our nerd, whatever the hell he is, our nerd emperor penguin, James Dyer.
Hello.
And, of course,
penguins.
The best-dressed man in film journalism, Amon Warren.
Hello.
How are you all?
Good.
You know, it's okay.
Well, we're on level 2 lockdown now, so you know.
By the time people listen to this, what are we now?
Well, we will be, because it comes in on Friday night, so it's so I guess depending on when you listen to it, it's either coming in or about to come in. Mm. But we are stepping up to Mauve Alert, which of course does mean changing the bulb.
Cracking red dwarf gag there, in case people didn't get the reference. How many degrees are you all separated from Kevin Bacon?
One.
Yeah, I mean, one. Well, the thing is, it depends if you have to, like, we haven't been in a movie with him. It depends how strict you are on the rules. Have I interviewed him? I think I have.
You think you have? He must have been scintillated.
I did at one point. You know when we did all those video interviews? We used to do video interviews for the website, and they'd be 5-minute interviews.
Yes.
And I don't remember everyone I did for those because they were so fast. I'm pretty sure I talked to him, though, because I'm pretty sure I had this conversation with myself.
The journalistic equivalent of speed dating.
Yeah, really. And about as memorable as most speed dates, you know. So
well, I think, Helen, like, you have the highest viewed one on Empire's YouTube channel with Tom Hiddleston, isn't it? Was it Tom Hiddleston and Benedict Cumberbatch?
Tom Hiddleston and Benedict Cumberbatch. Yeah. That's why it's the highest viewed interview on Empire's social channels. Yeah.
I also got 1 degree closer to Kevin Bacon recently. I also interviewed him for You Should Have Left. So yeah, I guess 2, 3. I don't know how the game works.
So what is that? Are we 1 degree? I've interviewed him before. I've even been in the same room as him. But does that mean I'm 1 degree from Kevin Bacon, or do I have to have worked with someone who has worked with someone who has worked with someone who has worked with Kevin Bacon? Is that how it works?
I don't know.
Is that the idea of the game? The six degrees of Kevin Bacon, in case people don't know what we're talking about?
I'm on EE. Does that mean I'm automatically 1 degree of Kevin Bacon?
Does that mean he comes around and checks your phone out? And
he does. Whenever I have a problem, he's the tech support guy. Yeah. I'm trying to fix it.
What a guy.
That guy's still cashing residual EE checks. Those adverts. Fair play.
Oh, he's still doing them.
He's still, the pandemic has not stopped him. He's still beavered away. And absolutely, more power to his elbow. That's what I say. If you can do it, you can do it. But if EE are thinking of dropping him at any time and hiring someone else who's significantly cheaper and available, then yeah. Both Amon and myself are definitely 1 degree closer to Kevin Bacon than we once were. So it's like Kevin Bacon.
Pretty much Kevin Bacon.
It's pretty much it's like vegan bacon. That's basically what we are. But anyway, enough talk about Kevin Bacon. And because the three-fact structure has been postponed to next week, even though Amon and James had backup facts, Helen,
I can pull something off the top of my head. But like,
oh, really?
You know, I'm just
okay,
not going to vouch for it.
Look, hey, folks, looks like the three-fact structure's back this week. Okay, keep it quick, keep it short. Amon, you said you had one in reserve. What is your fact? Wow me.
Okay, so I was researching one of my favorite films of all time, Gladiator, recently. for a piece. And
I'm not entertained.
Give it a second, James. I'm warming up to it, okay? Goodness me.
The tiger's not real. Corsico's not real. Rome wasn't real.
It wasn't built in a day.
It's true.
Certainly wasn't. It takes a long time to do CG like that.
Unless it's a Scorpion King, in which case it is a day.
My gosh, that film. But yes, Gladiator. I discovered that Russell Crowe's look in that film was inspired by none other than George Michael. I did not know this, but it was inspired by... Russell Crowe's haircut was inspired by the Jesus to a Child cover album, the George Michael album. And that is that is how he modeled his look.
Hang on. Where have you got this so-called fact from?
This is on the commentary of Gladiator. This is the commentary track. Russell Crowe says it.
I thought you meant that Russell Crowe was in a barber shop getting his haircut, and then George Michael drove a car through the window of the barber's, and the barber accidentally just shaved off his hair in fright, and he had to go with it. That's where I thought you were going with that. But no, it's actual inspiration. Okay, I can see that.
Although that is what I think happened with Hawkeye in Infinity War. He must have been mid-haircut or something, and the barber just faded away. That's the only explanation for whatever the hell that is on his head in that film.
Well, instead of starting Endgame with Hawkeye's family blipping, they could have, or you know, disappearing in the snap, they could have just had him in a barbershop having his haircut.
It would have made more sense.
And the scissors just fall to the floor as the barber gets snapped, leaving him unfinished and unable to get the haircut completed and just walking out.
Yeah.
So Hawkeye's story in Avengers Endgame is he's a bloke traveling the world looking for someone to finish him off. Is that basically where
it works? Yes. That is the subplot.
So many poorly chosen words in that sentence.
Also, it was a 5-year period. Like, his hair would have grown again. So I don't think this holds up at all.
See, this is my problem with Natasha's hair in Endgame. I think that,
that's 5 years worth of growth.
Is it 5 years worth of color change? Because surely her color would have reverted a lot quicker than that.
No, but like the bit at the bottom was bleached, and then the bit at the top is her
just
natural
out,
red.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
but would it take 5 years or would it take long?
Yeah, but you don't know when she stopped bleaching. She may have, bleached for a period of time after the snap, just been bereft, friends are dead, go to a stylist, make yourself feel better, and then eventually realise it just wasn't doing it for her, so she let it grow out.
All right.
Like it was about like 6-8 inches of red hair before the bleach bit, so that is probably about 5 years. I mean,
How fast does hair grow?
Well, I know that when I had a really, ill-advised short crop at one point for reasons.
Did you?
When did you have
a short crop?
Hang on, Helen, I've known you for about 40 years.
Yeah,
when
there
did
was
you have
like
a short...
45 ago in that case. It was when I was at uni. I went in to get a cut to like bottom of my chin level. The guy cut it to like middle of my ear level, which was horrific on a whole other scale. So then I had to get like a crop after that and get it to sort of just like a, just short hair length. And then it took me a year to grow it out to like a mini bob. And then it took another year or two to get to like shoulder length again. So,
it takes
a while.
Is this your fact? Because you're winning.
No, but I do. My fact is hair related, so maybe I should follow on from Amon.
Fuck it. All right, Helen, let's go for it.
My fact is about indirectly how Barbra Streisand came to direct. Have I told you this one?
Is this anything to do with John Peters?
It does have something to do with John Peters. So Barbra Streisand, obviously in the 70s, had a long relationship with John Peters, who became a very famous Hollywood producer, has had a very long and successful career in many ways, but started out as a hairstylist. Started out working around Hollywood as a sort of celebrity hairstylist, which is how he met Streisand and how they got together. Then, he becomes her boyfriend. He talks to her a lot. He has great ideas. He wants to get involved in everything. Obviously wanted to break into the movie business. So when she was working on her version of A Star Is Born, the one with Kris Kristofferson, Peters put himself forward to direct it based on absolutely fucking nothing. Like, he'd done nothing at that point. He wasn't a producer yet. He certainly hadn't got any directing experience. He just cut hair. And Barbra Streisand thought to herself, if this dude has the chutzpah to, put himself forward for this job, what the fuck am I waiting for? And it was that led her to decide to make Yentl herself, to direct Yentl herself. She'd already been working on it for a long time, trying to get it made. But it was John Peters putting himself forward for A Star Is Born that made her direct it.
Wow.
So it's only tangentially hair related, but it
took
is hair related.
Took her a while to get around to it, though, didn't it?
What, after that? Well, yeah, because it took a long time for any of the studios to get behind it because they didn't see the commercial appeal in this film, which did make money at the box office, did win awards, did get very good reviews. But yeah, it did take her a while to get it made. And she had to add the musical numbers to get it made. It was not originally going to have any songs whatsoever.
And Joan Peters was also suggesting that there should be a giant spider in Yentl Live.
A giant robot spider that she should fight in order to graduate, from rabbinical school.
Papa, can you hear that? It's a giant robot. You know, that song from the Yentl Live's cut.
Do you want to build a snowman?
Do you want to fight a spider? All right, two good facts so far. Jimbo, let's bring this bad boy home.
Oh, God. So my fact is I wish to explore the connection between Tom Cruise and the forces of hell.
See,
so
I wish you not to explore it.
I can. I can just not do this fact. I'm more than happy to. We can just move on. A forced verdict.
What is the connection between who and what?
Well, I'm not sure I want to tell you now.
Oh, go on. Tell me. Don't tell him. Tell me.
Fine. This fact is just for Helen.
Yes, I'm going to mute my headphones.
And as all great facts for Helen... Yeah, it's a bit for Amon as well. It's as all great facts for Helen's begin, this is about a video game, because I know that Helen is a rabid gamer and will, of course, appreciate it.
Yeah.
So, cast your mind back to 1986 and the release of The Color of Money. There is a scene in The Color of Money set in a pool hall. You might be surprised here.
What?
And at one point, a guy approaches Tom Cruise's character, kind of swaggers up to him, and he nods to the case in Tom Cruise's lap and says, "What have you got in there?" And Tom Cruise looks at it, he goes, "In here." And he looks at it and he caresses the case. And then he says, "Doom." Not quite like that. And then he does the Tom Cruise grin. He does the Tom Cruise grin and proceeds to kick the guy's ass at Paul.
Naturally.
Obviously,
it's
what the film's about. But that moment is what inspired a guy called John Carmack, who was the co-founder of id Software. When he released the game Doom in 1993, it is called Doom because that was the moment. He said that he thought this game, which was a game-changing first-person shooter...
It's the one I've played.
Which Helen has played, when he dropped that on the game industry, he wanted it to feel like that moment. Like, what have you got in that box? And he's like, Doom. So to create that kind of, you know, Tom Cruise-y Color of Money swagger, that's why he called Doom, Doom.
Oh, that's good.
And just in case people don't know, Doom is one of the most iconic video games ever made. So it's not just some random thing I pulled out.
It's the one I've played.
It's what Helen's played it. It is so famous, Helen, who hates all things video game, has played this game.
Have you seen the film?
Yeah.
Doom, yes, I have.
Yeah. Unfortunately,
it's got Lawrence Johnson in it. He's really good in that. That's a niche gag.
I don't know how this happened, but a tweet went up on the Empire Twitter feed about an hour ago. Saying Sarah Shahi has joined Dwayne Lawrence in Black Adam.
What?
Dwayne Lawrence. I mean, I can maybe understand people going, "Oh, Dwayne Roxon," or getting it wrong a little bit, but not inventing a completely different surname for the man. Like, he's one of the most famous people on the planet. So we're trying to get to the bottom of how this tweet happened.
Rock the Dwayne Johnson.
Yes, Rock the Dwayne Johnson, as we used to call him all the time on the website back in the good old days. So it's Dwayne Johnson, not Dwayne Lawrence, or Lawrence Johnson, as I referred to him in an amusing follow-up tweet that confused people because they thought we were having a stroke. I think that's why.
We can't rule that out.
No, we can't.
I really want to know Dwayne Johnson's middle name now. Is it Lawrence?
Oh, if it is, then this is super meta.
Wow.
I'm going to look it up. Okay.
If it is Dwayne Lawrence Johnson, then I think we get off on a technicality.
I hope he was christened The Rock as his middle name.
It is not Lawrence. Would you care to take a guess? It is as Luca Brasi might say, it's a masculine name. It is a name that is...
Bruno.
Rocky.
It can be a surname and a first name. It is a surname that is perhaps very, very famous for a Hollywood dynasty of some kind. So
Barry Moore.
Baldwin.
Dwayne Baldwin Johnson. That would be amazing. Not Houston, but like a very famous actor, producer.
Douglas.
Yes.
Dwayne Douglas Johnson.
Huh. Dwayne the Doug Johnson. That's great. I love it.
DDJ, Dwayne Douglas Johnson. Anyway, back to the three-fact stretcher, and I can officially declare this week's winner to be James. That fact impressed me quite a lot, as did the other fact as well, but that was a good one. And it will be back next week. Keep them brief. Ugh. Brevity is the key, folks. Brevity is the key. I've always said that. I've always said that brevity is the key, going all the way back to the beginning.
Chris. Yes.
This is a famously brief podcast, so yes. That makes absolute sense.
I am trying to keep it below 4 weeks. It's the recording session. Okay, so that was the three-fact structure, and now it is time to get into the listener question, which this week comes, as indeed most weeks it does, from Twitter. And I think a Twitter question asker newcomer. I don't recall this name popping up before. At Ben_Oliver1982. And they ask, best ever use of prosthetics without a shred of CG on a human character in a film? I was actually going to have this as a question this week anyway, and then of course we saw this week that the Batman is up filming in Liverpool. Mm. There's been pictures of Robert Pattinson and his frankly un-Bruce Wayne-like hair running around Liverpool.
Right, is it?
I don't like it. I don't like it, Helen.
I don't approve. Yeah. I mean, Nightwing can have that hair. Even Daredevil could have that hair. I don't think that's Bruce Wayne hair.
This is a very hairy episode of the podcast.
It is quite hairy, isn't it? Good Lord.
Amon and I are feeling quite discriminated.
Do you want a number to call? Do you want a hotline? I'm not sure about it. It's a hair that says, help, George Michael drove into my barbers halfway through this haircut. But the reason this is relevant to the question, Robert Pattinson's Batman hair aside, is, of course, Colin Farrell is in Liverpool this week as well. And it is him in heavy, heavy prosthetics as Oswald Cobblepot, a.k.a. the Penguin. And I have to say, guys, that's really fucking good makeup.
It's really good, but if you're going to paint over the Mona Lisa, like, it better be good. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't... Why would you do that to that face? It's very upsetting to me. It's like, it makes Charlize Theron's makeup in Monster look positively understated. Like, I just don't understand why people must... vandalize beautiful people.
Someone said that he looks like someone microwaved Bruce Campbell. And someone else said, and this is a reference I think only maybe Amon might get in this room, but he looks like the former Arsenal manager George Graham. And he does. He really, really does. Yeah. So I can only imagine that the Batman is going to be all about the Penguin teaching his minions to hold a very, very tight back line and then get Batman on the offside trap.
Woodwatch.
That's good. Yes,
that's
Chris,
funny.
That was an amusing reference.
To football.
I'm sorry, I stopped listening.
Association football, eh?
There is an answer to this that I think is probably the right answer.
All right, good. We can all go home.
It's not necessarily the best film, I wouldn't say, but I do think that Kazuhiro Tsuji's makeup in The Darkest Hour on Winston Churchill is actually very good.
That's very good. See, I was gonna drop that, but I was gonna drop it as a sort of Gary Oldman double bill along with Bram Stoker's Dracula, because I think there will be no scoffing at Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is a film that
it's the same makeup artist, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, and he looks he's good.
You're very both good. Incorrect, because there is a correct answer to this question.
It's still not Norbert.
It is not Norbert, but it is to do with Eddie Murphy, because Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall in Coming to America.
Oh, yes.
Yep. The makeup in that is legendary. And obviously there's
Saul the barber in the barbershop.
Exactly. Yep. There's that famous story of the producers coming on set and, you know, Eddie Murphy being... in his sort of as Saul in his Jewish
in white face,
and they didn't know that it was him the entire time they were on set. That is incredible. So for me, that is the answer.
It is very good.
But I did have
it is very impressive.
I did have Gary Oldman. I did have Charlize Theron in Bombshell, which is also by Kazuhiro, and also another one that came to mind: Tilda Swinton in Suspiria when she plays Dr. Klemperer. If I didn't know that was her going in, I would never have guessed. That was pretty impressive as well.
You could tell it was something. Like, I didn't know. I think it hadn't been announced when I saw it. And I could tell it was something under there. But I couldn't tell who. But I mean, you can tell it's somebody under Winston Churchill, I guess. But I still think it's an incredible, incredible piece of makeup that, because, you know, it would be hard to find a white man who looks less like Winston Churchill than Gary Oldman. And yet they kind of got away with it anyway. So yeah, full props for that one.
Mark Wahlberg makes some pretty good use of prosthetics in Boogie Nights. The less said about that, the better. I want to give a shout to Mrs. Doubtfire. I think that's excellent. Not least of all because she applies it and unapplies it on screen.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's great.
It is very well done. Shout. Yeah, absolutely.
Jimbo, if we had gone for wrong actors only, who would you have gone for? I'm Norbert. Thinking, for example.
Makeup isn't the problem, and I was Oscar nominated.
Don't you dare diss Rick Baker.
Don't diss Rasputia.
White girls would probably be in there for the wrong answers.
Oh, True Identity. Remember True Identity?
No.
Who can forget True Identity?
Indeed.
Oh. Well, not white girls, white chicks. I said white girls?
White chicks.
No, I mean.
White chicks, yeah. We've all erased it from our mind, Damon. Don't worry, it's
rightly
totally
so.
Fine.
Rightly so.
It's only good for the 1,000-mile scene.
I don't even remember that.
Terry Crews in the car.
Iconic scene. Iconic. We may need to talk about your use of the word iconic.
That is an iconic scene. Like,
you had to remind me of it. Anyway, I'm arguing that's not iconic. Does anyone remember Dan Aykroyd's directorial debut, Nothing But Trouble?
And his prosthetics in that film.
Oh my God, it's so bad. But remember a few weeks ago when we did that discussion about... Coneheads, yes, because I totally bought that they had cones in their heads.
We said human characters only, so forget that I said it. That doesn't count.
We didn't.
The questioner did.
The question bloke did, yes. So that rules out things like Planet of the Apes. And
Lord of the Rings.
I mean, yeah. What's great in Lord of the Rings?
Well, the Uruks. The Orcs.
That is good.
Yeah. That is very good.
I will grant you that. There is a right answer here, and it's, I guess it is, as Amon said, it's Eddie Murphy adjacent, but only because Rick Baker is the answer, and it's American Werewolf in London. It's still
not human.
Absolutely.
Well, he is human. He is human. He just becomes a wolf. I know. It's a grey area, that one is. But yeah, the that's amazing. And it's just so tragic when you go from that and then you watch American Werewolf in Paris and you're like, what were you thinking?
What were they doing? What were they doing? Oh, God, because if it's non-human, then that rules out Robotine for the thing. And my thing about this is that, by and large, horror films tend to get overlooked in this stuff. So remember a few weeks ago we did the 80s soundtrack question and we ended up looking at the best original song category in the Oscars and finding it more often than not, they just reward middle of the road nonsense ahead of some truly iconic songs. Sure. And I mean iconic in the sense that that scene from White Chicks is iconic, of course. So I'm just having a quick look here at the best makeup and hairstyling winners and nominees over the years.
And now in fairness, it was brought in because of horror.
You say that. But at the same time, I don't see Tom Savini's name in here as a nominee. I don't see Greg Nicotero's name or Howard Berger's names on here as nominees very often, if at all. Rick Baker is genius and wins loads of stuff. But for example, Howard Berger of KNB has won an Oscar, but was for The Chronicles of Narnia and none of the incredible horror stuff he's done over the years. And so there's still that snobbery even within the industry, which is wild. But yes, it came in 1981 for Rick Baker in American Werewolf in London. Rob Bottin didn't get nominated that same year for the incredible work he did also in The Howling, which is mad. But so I'm just going to go very, very quickly through some of these and see if any of these stand out for you. So Amadeus, 1984, some decent Dick Smith.
Very good aging there.
Old age makeup. Dick Smith is the king of that sort of stuff. If you look at The Exorcist, I think the idea we always had that Max von Sydow was in his 70s is because, like perpetually in his 70s, is because of The Exorcist and the makeup and that being so, so good. Harry and the Hendersons, Bigfoot and the Hendersons won in 1987. Chris Wallace for The Fly. So The Fly, Jeff Goldblum.
The Fly, does it count as human at that point?
Brundlefly.
Brundlefly. Dick Tracy, there's good prosthetics, 1990.
Dick Tracy, but again, so I know they're like technically human characters, but they're not going for realistic human characters in that film, are they?
That wasn't a stipulation.
I mean, it should be, I feel like, reading between the lines. Yeah.
I don't think so.
They're grotesque.
They're absolutely, but they're not like within the realm of realism grotesque.
I mean, they're not
for
aliens unless I'm massively misreading the plot of that film.
I mean, maybe. Make it quite interesting. I love that film. I think it's hugely underrated.
Is it though?
Yeah. But then in fairness, that's a very quoted film in my home growing up. The line, when do we eat, is enormously useful in many circumstances.
I mean, that's just something you say in everyday conversation.
No, but we say it in the way that the orphan says it in the film. It's a whole thing. Also, okay. The songs are fucking great.
So Bram Stoker's Dracula also won the Academy Award, you'd be delighted to know,
correct,
for Greg Canham, Michelle Burke, and Matthew W. Mungle. Mrs. Doubtfire won.
Good.
Yeah.
In 1993,
yes,
beating Philadelphia
right,
and Schindler's List.
What won in 2009?
Beating Il Divo and The Young Victoria. My God, how do they decide these films to be nominated? Star Trek.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, no, okay.
Because of...
Painting people green? Aliens and such?
There was an Orion girl. It was green. I don't know if she had any prosthetics on.
Eric Barnes Niva was well done. But I'm just thinking of The Dark Knight and Heath Ledger and that makeup job and prosthetic job was very impressive also.
2008. It was nominated 2008 alongside Hellboy 2. Mike Elisaldi, who's also a genius prosthetics bloke, didn't win. Hellboy 2 didn't win. The Dark Knight didn't win. They were both beaten by The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Mm.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I think that one was battling the uncanny valley a little bit for me. Like, it's very, I can tell it's very impressive and I still didn't buy it at the time. It was an odd one.
It was an odd one, wasn't it? I'm still not entirely sure how I feel about that film. I did feel a lot by the time it ended that I had lived an entire life in reverse, so maybe that was the point.
Yeah, it's very strange.
I haven't seen that film in a long time.
I mean, there's a lot of really good prosthetics jobs recently, you know, a lot of great stuff in the MCU as well. It never seems to get nominated, which is very, very strange. But I'm just real quick, I'm just going to go through and pull out some of the other ones that stand out to me. Braveheart won. Well, for painting a blue bit on Mel Gibson's face.
an anachronistic blue bit at that.
Oh, I know. It took me out of the movie. I was furious.
I know, right?
It did halfway decent leprosy.
I mean, if we're talking leprosy, then the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven would surely run away with
that. Oh, my goodness. Don't even get me started on that.
Got lepers up the wazoo.
Rick Baker won in 1996 for The Nutty Professor.
Yes, I was going to mention that. It was really, really good.
Yeah. It was very good.
He also won again, along with David Leroy Anderson, both years, for Men in Black, which is fantastic. But I'm trying to think of the great prosthetics on a human character in that. There's loads of other great bits of makeup.
Any, isn't it? Vincent D'Onofrio gets the bulk of it. He's technically a human character. He's just got an alien, you know, in him.
Okay.
Because he starts human, doesn't he? He's just got a cockroach alien in him.
Yeah, as you do.
Some absolutely wild shouts here. There really are. How the Grinch Stole Christmas, 2000.
Yeah, it's very green.
It's not necessarily the winners sometimes, it's the other nominees. So How the Grinch Stole Christmas beat Shadow of the Vampire. Actually, Shadow of the Vampire has great makeup in it because Willem Dafoe looks exactly like Max Schreck from the Murnau film. So, wow, that's an interesting one. But then Carrie, that's very good prosthetics. But is it on a human? I don't know. Lemony Snicket's A Series of Force and Defense, Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe. They made Liam Neeson look like a lion. That's pretty impressive. I'm bang on board with that. Pan's Labyrinth won in 2006. That's great.
Yeah. That's great prosthetics. Yeah.
The Wolfman, Rick Baker again, but a lot of CG in that, which wasn't terribly good. The Iron Lady, 2011. Where's Monster in this list? Monster wasn't even nominated.
That's madness.
And the whole point of that performance is that Charlize Theron is, I would say, almost legitimately unrecognizable, which takes some doing. It has to be said. So don't know what the hell was going on there. Les Miserables won this somehow. I don't know how. Beating Hitchcock and The Hobbit and Unexpected Journey. Dallas Buyers Club, Grand Budapest Hotel, Mad Max Fury Road, Suicide Squad, Darkest Hour, Vice, and Bombshell.
Did Coming to America win?
No. It was beaten by Beetlejuice.
Okay, yeah, I can't imagine that.
Scrooge was also beaten that same year.
I just thought of another option for your wrong answers only. Looper. They tried to make Joseph Gordon-Levitt look like Bruce Willis.
Liked what they did there. I liked that. That was very subtle. Didn't work because...
They didn't go full Willis.
Well, the problem is we know what young Bruce Willis looks like.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. So it's not going to work for you. But I liked what they did with his nose and, you know, When we're saying bat makeup here, what do you mean? Like it falling, the nose falling off in the middle of the scene? Like maybe if you were doing a school play and your eyebrows came off while you were trying desperately to, you know, paste them back on. It's not quite that bad. But yeah, I don't have an answer beyond anything Rick Baker has done. But I just would like some geniuses like Greg Nicotero and Tom Savini to be recognized in this category going forward. And Rob Bottin, the great Rob Bottin, who is no longer working in the industry. Mm. And what a shame that is. If you want to have your question read out on the Emperor podcast and treated with the respect it deserves as, I've forgotten his name. How's that from respect?
Ben.
Ben. At Ben_Oliver1982. I don't think that's his full name, if I'm honest with you. But you can get in touch with us via a number of methods, mainly Twitter these days. So just slide into my DMs. I'm at Chris Hewitt on Twitter, or reply to one of my tweets, or wait for the odd shout out. Didn't have to do one this week because Ben sent in this question in reply to last week's shout out. And I've actually banked a couple for future episodes. So no shout outs for me for the time being. And it is time now for this week's guest. And as mentioned earlier on, it is the one, the only, Kevin Bacon. And we all feel a little bit closer now to Kevin Bacon. And what a career this guy has had. It was, ooh, let me see now, 40 years ago. 40 wow. years ago that Tom Savini, the aforementioned Tom Savini, was shoving a fake arrow through Kevin Bacon's chest for Friday the 13th. And that was basically where he got his start, being killed by not Jason Voorhees, but Mrs. Voorhees in that original slasher movie. But despite that, he got better and he went on to do all sorts of stuff. You know, there's, let me see what else. Let's list Kevin Bacon movie, shall we? Footloose.
JFK.
Tremors.
A Few Good Men.
Tremors.
Apollo 13.
Oh yeah, love that.
And of course, the wonderful Stir of Echoes, which he made 21 years ago. And that saw him team up with David Koepp, the legendary screenwriter David Koepp, who was then turning his hand to directing as well. 21 years have passed, but the two are still firm friends and they are working together again for the first time since then. They've worked together again since Kevin Bacon has voiced an audio short story that David Koepp has written, which is out now on Audible. But they are back on the Welsh set horror film You Should Have Left. You should have bloody left! You should have left! Which came out this week on PVOD, available to rent or buy wherever you rent or buy such things. Kevin Bacon jumped onto Zoom, the dread Zoom, with me a few weeks ago, and we had a nice chat. I don't think there are too many sound issues with this one. So here we are, Kevin Bacon and I talking about horror, working with David Koepp, and all sorts of other stuff besides, including, I think, the EE adverts. Interesting. Enjoy. EE, enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast in lockdown, of course, by the star of You Should Have Left, Mr. Kevin Bacon. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you.
Good to hear. Whereabouts in the world are you at the moment?
I'm in northwestern Connecticut. We have a farm up here, and this is where we've been for, I guess, 3 months, 4 months, something like that.
Okay. So is that somewhere that you, whenever the pandemic started hitting and lockdown came in full effect, you thought, okay, we're gonna go here now, or is this somewhere that you spent a lot of your time anyway?
Well, this is a place where we spent a lot of time anyway, but but it definitely was. It's been a great place to be during the pandemic. We go back and forth from Manhattan, and you know, listen, I mean, we can go outside and not wear a mask because there's nobody here. So it's a real different kind of, you know, life when you're in the city, which I still love and adore, New York City. And we're still going down and, you know, sort of checking in with our hometown every once in a while, but it's a lot easier being here with no mask.
I can imagine. I'm still doing the mask thing every time I pop out to the shops here in London.
Oh, believe me, we do it in New York too, and it's very important. I mean, I, you know, you can't emphasize enough. You know, in the little town down the road from us, I just got back from the grocery store, and of course, you know, put on my mask the second I stepped out of the car, and that seems to be that seems to be one thing that the virus doesn't like, and therefore we should embrace it.
Absolutely. And but generally speaking, how have you been doing in lockdown? How have you been coping? Have you been keeping yourself busy and creative?
I feel very, very grateful to have a roof over my head, to have food to eat, to have someone that I love to be in lockdown with. And so we're doing okay. You know, I mean, it's funny. We were talking the other day about how we've been married 32 years in September. And
congrats.
We've never spent this much time together ever. I mean, in 32 years, it's because, you know, we're vagabonds. We have suitcases packed and we're always ready to go someplace on the road. And if we're not on the road, we figure out a way to get on the road. And I think in some ways, as much as we love spending time together, that's been what's, you know, really helped us hold this marriage together. It's just the fact that we do have some kind of separation sometimes. So the fact that we're surviving, the marriage is surviving this kind of being really like right on top of each other is actually remarkable. So we're very, very happy with that. And in terms of creativity, honestly, yeah. I mean, I have been doing a lot of stuff creatively, but I also feel like it's less out of a desire to be creative and more out of a desire to have a job. I'm just like a working type person, you know what I mean? Mm. I just need to get up every day and figure out something to do that feels like work. I don't like vacations. I don't like the golf course. I don't like, you know, building. I mean, you know what I mean? I want to do something that, so yeah, I've written some songs, you know, made some videos of that songs. My wife and I wrote, directed, shot, operated a short that we're in the middle of working on now. I did another video for another tune the other day. Yeah, I mean, I've been really busy, I have to say.
Amazing. It must help as well, Kevin, that you have so many hats, though, that, you know, you're not just an actor, but you're a musician as well. And it, you can turn your hand to any number of things, really. Keep yourself busy, keep your hand in creatively.
Yeah, I can. The other thing that's really nice is that in this day and age, you know, technology has afforded us the opportunity to really have at our fingertips great tools to create things. I mean, for instance, I wanted to do a video of this new song, and I've never really understood or I've never really dove into stop motion animation. And all of a sudden I was like, well, that would be a good thing for this song. So I started to like learn through apps, basically stop motion animation. And it's been really, really fun. And as you can imagine, it's very time consuming.
Yes, it is. I can imagine you get maybe, what, 1 or 2 seconds in a day? And that's pretty much it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm not as... Yeah, I mean, if you're really, really serious at it, that's true. Yes, you would. But, you know, I'm a little more sloppy than that. Let's put it that way.
You're not quite Ray Harryhausen yet.
I don't know who that is, but I'm sure I'm not.
Obviously, you filmed... You should have left long before there was a pandemic, long before there was a lockdown. Maybe this is just something I'm finding with a lot of movies these days, but I watched it and I thought, oh, this is a movie just made for these times, isn't it? I mean, you know, this is about your character in this, not creepy necessarily because it's a lovely house, but in lockdown, in isolation and going slowly mad. And it feels like it was made 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, no, it definitely has that vibe. And, we... We're going to release it on PVOD, you know, paid video in the States anyway. And then all of a sudden we started thinking, you know, maybe this is a good time for this movie. It's three people that are, you know, in this house that keeps pulling them back, that they have a hard time, you know, leaving. And there's a lot of things that are happening in this country. A lot of people are wanting to move into more isolated communities. You see that again and again and again. You know, this kind of idea of online rentals is really taken off, and people are heading for different, you know, rental houses in order to get some distance from the from everybody else. And the movie just kind of lined right up with that. You know, it's not about a pandemic.
No.
So and it's not, obviously we didn't we didn't know we were going to have a pandemic, you know, when we made the movie. Mm. Well, maybe Bill Gates did, but we didn't know. So it just was kind of serendipitous.
I like that you mentioned that you just come back from the grocery store in the town near where you live now, because there's a very interesting, funny scene in this movie where you go to a grocery store in a small town in Wales and get pretty short shrift. I'm guessing you don't get the same treatment in your local grocery store.
No, they treat me pretty well. I mean, I've been here, you know, since 1983. But I can tell you that what they don't treat me like is a movie star. They are, you know, everybody is very like, it has a little bit of that Welsh kind of vibe around here where it's a pretty tight knit kind of community. And if you're coming in, you know, as a tourist or whatever, they're definitely aware of that and possibly, you know, treat you a little bit differently. Mm. Yeah, that was a fun little, scene to shoot, and my favorite thing is when the guy, I say to the guy, well, I'm he says something and I say, I'm so sorry, I don't speak Welsh, and he goes, it was English.
Was that your experience in Wales, generally speaking?
No, not so much. I mean, I think that people, you know, probably knowing that we were Americans, you know, would you know, probably make their accent, dial their accent down a little bit, so it became a little clearer. But I have to say that it, being in Wales and shooting in Wales was fantastic. The writer, David, he said it in Wales, and I'd never been there. I didn't know anything really about the Welsh countryside other than just kind of an image, you know, in my mind of it. But it was very, very helpful, I think, to the tone of the movie and certainly the look of the movie. And it also, I think, helped us, you know, from an acting standpoint to really, you know, make it even more real.
It's a really interesting film, actually, because it's got, you know, on one level, yes, it's a horror film. But on another level, it's a character study, partially of a marriage that's seen better days, for one thing, but also of your character as well, who is burdened, shall we say, by, you know, the baggage of his past, and is slowly but surely falling apart. But at the same time, Kevin, there are notes of dark humor all the way through it. This, you know, it is at times a very funny performance. Was that something that you and David were keen to layer, so it wasn't just your jump scare filled horror film? There's something else going on here.
Well, to me, yes, absolutely. And Dave has a really dark sense of humor. And even in the darkest stuff that he writes, he always injects a kind of, I don't know, there's just a great kind of quality of turn of phrase that he has of looking at life and even the darkest parts of life and putting a slightly funny kind of spin on it. That's just a great talent that he has as a writer. And yeah, I mean, that was important to us. And we also really wanted to make a film that was character based because, you know, the great horror films to me, in the vein of Rosemary's Baby and Don't Look Now and The Shining, Get Out, you know, these are all real character movies, you know, that's the kind of horror that I am interested in. A film where even if you took out the supernatural or the scary kind of part of it, it would still to me be an interesting thing to explore. And the exploration here is, as you said, about a guy who is married to a woman who's way too young for him, and about the paranoia and jealousy that's made its way into their relationship. And also about this man who has dark things in his past and things that he has done in his past that are starting to kind of come up for him or never really went away. And I think that in the era of Me Too and certainly in the current climate of social and racial justice that's in this country, you know, a lot of stuff that people have done in their past is starting to come up, and it's even more evident because of the digital footprint that we've been leaving through for a lot of years, you know. Mm. So
the movie has to do partly with how do you pay for your sins and how do you forgive yourself for your sins or not, or are you ever able to pay for them? You know, I mean, it's like that kind of thematic stuff are the things we wanted to deal with in this film.
It's the second time that you've worked with David Koepp. Last time was Stir of Echoes, another great psychological horror slash thriller. And looking at your career over the years, Kevin, it's actually quite unusual for you, I think, to work with the same director more than once.
Yeah, they never hire me twice. Maybe that's not my choice. That's not my choice.
Okay, interesting. But I had noticed, for example, that you worked with Ron Howard a couple of times. You worked with Barry Levinson a couple of times. But by and large, this is you're a one and done kind of chap. But it's not your decision. It's theirs.
No, it really isn't. Honestly, I don't think I could. With the amount of movies that I've done, it's a very small list of directors that I would not want to work with again. And in the case of Stir of Echoes, I had such a great time with David, and we were so happy with the result from that film. And it's a genre that I, you know, love. And I just kind of felt like we could do this again. And so I started, you know, kind of bugging him about it. And it took 20 years, but I finally wore him down. And and we made this movie, and it was equally as exciting a process for both of us, and creatively satisfying. And I recently did an audiobook reading of a fantastic novella that he wrote, and you know, I hope we can keep collaborating, you know, for a long time, because it's I love working with him.
The directors that you have worked with in the past, a couple of times, the likes of Barry Levinson and Ron Howard, as I said, you know, it was that a similar situation where you clicked with them first time around, or is it just something that swings around a few years later? I mean, there's a fair gap, for example, between Diner and Sleepers.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, directors go off and they get scripts, and they have, you know, parts that are, you know, worth exploring or not. And it's just, you know, you can't, it's hard to control that. I mean, I certainly, you know, would have gone back to work with Ron in a second. You know, it wasn't until Frost Nixon that something came around that he, you know, thought I was right for, or, you know, whatever. And the same thing with Barry. It's just that's just the way it goes. I think that, you know, as an actor, you don't, there's a lot of things that are out of your control.
Yeah.
Even if you're a successful actor, the image is kind of that, you know, you're making your own rules. You know what I mean? That everyone is just gonna is lining up at your door, but you know, it's not really the case. I mean, you have directors have to do what directors are going to do. They've got to do what's best for the picture, you know, and it's not always a question of, you know, just casting the same people again and again. Now, there are some people that kind of put a company together and use that company, you know, frequently. But I guess I've just never been in that club somehow.
You're in the David Koepp club, and
that's good enough for me.
It's just you and him at the moment, but that's fine. One of the things that I think over here over the last few years in this country, particularly, you know, that people will have seen you in a lot are the EE commercials that you do over here. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask specifically, one of the ones that came up a few years ago really tickled me is the one where you played a number of your famous roles. The House Full of Bacons.
Right, right.
I just wanted to know if you had any input into the roles that were selected for those commercials.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't remember if I did. I think probably not. Listen, you know, they have amazing writers and directors and funny ideas. I have to say that this string of commercials that I've made has been fantastic for me. Because first off, they're a lot of fun and I get to do all kinds of goofy stuff in them. And so that
you know, I can make fun of myself and be seen in a way where I'm not, where I don't really take myself too seriously, you know, yep. Because it's like, I really take my work as seriously as I possibly can. And I think that certainly in this industry and in Hollywood, I am thought of as like kind of like the stuff that I'm involved with is sort of intense and dark, you know?
Yeah.
So, but that's not the 100, that's not 100% kind of who I am. You know, I really like to joke around and do, you know, silly stuff. And the East spots have really, you know, given me that opportunity. And, you know, it's been great. It's a great gift to have had this relationship with them for so many years. And generally, you know, these things last whatever, a year or two. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So it's great. And, you know, I, when they came to me with that movie club thing, I thought, okay, this is a great, there was just something about that and about the kind of idea of 6 degrees and the having hung out for so long and done all these different kinds of things. It was like a perfect silly, you know, thing for me to fit really nicely into. But to answer your question, I think they picked the roles, not me.
If you had picked your roles, is there one that you would have put in there that they didn't go for?
Oh God, I don't know. Let's see. Maybe Tremors, was that in there? I can't remember.
I think he was mentioned, but he wasn't available.
He was deep
underground, if I remember rightly.
Well, okay. I think I would have done that one. You know, the funny thing about that, speaking about, you know, scary movies, is that I made that movie, and it's really the only character that I've ever thought about revisiting, because I think that he was an interesting character because he's not like really, you know, people always, when writers always describe characters and they always do this, they go, well, you know, he's a very smart, you know, he's streetwise, but he's smart. Well, you know, he's whatever, but he's smart. And this guy was just not smart, which is one of the things that was really fun about playing him. And he had this he's an ordinary guy who had this extraordinary circumstance. And I was really interested in seeing what would happen to him 25 years later.
Yeah.
And we developed it into, with Blumhouse, by the way, into a really excellent pilot, which we shot. Mm. And one of my greatest disappointments in my career is that the network decided not to move forward with that series. It was a really, really funny take on it. And mostly it was just fun to get back into that guy's skin. You know, he's essentially sort of the same man, but, you know, has just gone into a, you know, he's just a mess, you know, and looks beaten up and can't really walk as well. You know what I mean? It was all that kind of stuff was really fun, but so I think that would probably be the one.
That would be the one. That's it. I mean, when you play a guy called Valentine McKee, I mean, the name tells you pretty much what you need to know about him, right? I mean, that's where you start, I guess.
Absolutely. Great name.
Great name. Start with the name. That's a really good choice, Kevin. I'm one of the characters, weirdly enough, in that EE commercial, not to dwell too much on that, is your Friday the 13th character, complete with the arrow sticking through your chest.
Yeah.
Now, I know I've read a lot of interviews with you surrounding You Should Have Left, and I know that pretty much everybody who's talked to you about that movie brings up Friday the 13th because it's a horror film and because it's 40 years old this year. But from your point of view, that was one of your first gigs. You're killed fairly early in the film. Are you surprised or mystified that people still bring it up all these years later?
What I'm mystified about is, you know, because of cell phones and cameras, well, this was before the pandemic, autographs have kind of gone by the wayside. Nobody wants an autograph. They want a selfie, right? Which they don't anymore because you've got a mask on and you're 6 feet apart. And so, the selfie is one of the silver linings of the pandemic is that the selfie has pretty much disappeared. Uh-huh.
But there still are actual autograph hounds who will meet you at an airport or an event and have stacks and stacks of 8x10s for you to sign with a blue Sharpie. Always a blue Sharpie, because blue doesn't fade as quickly as black, apparently, in the world of Sharpies. So I call them blue men. And blue men, I would say 80% of the time, hand me a picture of me dead in Friday the 13th with an arrow sticking out of my throat and my face covered with blood. I don't understand why the one picture you want is me dead. But I have signed countless, countless numbers of me dead pictures to the point where it just gets, after a while, it just gets a little disturbing.
You know what you should do? You should just go around with a stack of pre-signed photographs and then just hand them out, preempt them.
That's a very good idea.
It all comes full circle eventually. But Kevin, it's been an absolute pleasure. I will let you go, but best of luck for the future with your stop motion animation.
Thanks. Watch out for it. It's coming soon.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, so that was Kevin Bacon, and You Should Have Left is out now on PVOD, and we'll be discussing it later on in the reviews section. But for now, it is time to talk about this week's movie news, and apart from the fact that Colin Farrell and Robert Pattinson are up in Liverpool shooting The Batman, there actually is some pretty big news this week. Mm. And I'm going to start with, I think, the biggest news, which is that it is confirmed at last that George Miller is going to make Furiosa, the prequel to Mad Max Fury Road, which is now officially entitled Mad Max Furiosa, despite the fact that Mad Max won't be in the film. And it is also confirmed that Anya Taylor-Joy, and I suspect that that was going to be the case, is going to play Furiosa. But that's not all. The cast has been swelled, and I use that word advisedly.
Swole.
It is swole and thick with the additions of Chris Hemsworth and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II.
Mm. I mean, very all exciting. Good people, all really yeah. good people. I'm not, you know, my position on prequels, but you know, they're all good people, and George Miller making another Mad Max universe movie has got to be an exciting thing. I just, you know, how do you have a happy ending's probably the wrong word, but how do you end a prequel to Furiosa's story? I don't know. But it'll be interesting.
I largely echo Helen. I'm a big fan of Fury Road, and I will follow George Miller all the way to Valhalla, shiny and chrome. Witness me!
Mediocre.
but I'd be infinitely more excited about a sequel with Charlize as opposed to this movie. I like all the people that have been cast, and I'm intrigued to see what story Miller wants to tell. But Charlize is what made Furiosa.
Yeah. Mm.
Without Charlize, we wouldn't be getting this movie. And I would where that story leaves that character, I'm like, I want to see what happens next after that. I don't necessarily want to go back to see how she got herself into the situation in the first place. But again, it's George Miller. Benefit of the doubt. Let's see what he wants.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'd much rather see what happens next with Charlize Theron. I mean, also, where is the Rictus Erectus origin story that we're all crying out for?
Yeah, I guess that's really what's missing. Yeah.
That's the big one. That's the one that people are all demanding. I get where you're coming from, and I do share those sentiments to a degree. But if this is the story he wants to tell, and he's a genius, and if it comes...
She's very good. She is very, very good.
She's tremendous. And of all the actresses who were in the running for it, or had been rumored to be in running for it, the second I heard her name, I was like, well, yeah, it's going to be her. It's going to be her. I should be a casting director. I'm really good at this.
Oh my God, you're so good at it. Wow.
Yeah, like, she's good. Cast her in something. That's, I presume, how it works. And the addition of Chris Hemsworth and Abdul-Mateen II is also really, really good casting. Some people were speculating might Hemsworth be playing a younger Immortan Joe, but I don't know if he's going to go down that route. And I also love how much it's going to piss off the people who were already angry at Max having to share the screen and somewhat defer to Furiosa in Fury Road, that this is a Mad Max film that won't have any Mad Max in it as well, which is great. Pissing off the right kind of people. I like it.
I predict that that title is changing before it gets released. I doubt Mad Max will still be in the title when all is said and done.
We shall see.
Argue you're cutting off a big part of your appeal with that, if you do that.
It feels like the studio would insist on it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because it feels like that adds money to the box office just by virtue of association.
But he's not in the movie.
Yeah, but it'd be one of these things. I'm sure that from a creative point of view, you're absolutely right. It shouldn't be there, and we wouldn't want it to be there. But studio's thinking, cha-ching!
Yeah.
And
It's weird, isn't it? Because I wouldn't have said Mad Max was a big, you know, draw before 2015. I think we actually had a conversation about this at one point when Empire was, you know, talking about putting it on the cover. And I'm like, is that really a selling point? Like, it's a cult series of films from 30 years ago, is it? It's not like Star Wars or something. Obviously, history showed it had a, if not a built-in audience, then certainly an audience that was intrigued enough to come out and see what all the fuss was about. So I guess they're relying on that name recognition rather than the 40 years worth before it.
Yeah, 100%.
I will also say I hope Junkie XL comes back to score this movie, because Brothers in Arms is still one of the best tracks that's been released in the last decade or so. And if you can get more music like that.
Mm. If there's no Doof Warrior, I'm walking out.
Yeah, seriously.
It's just a prequel of Young Doof Warrior. Just a bloke learning to play his flame-throwing guitar.
Burning his eyebrows off as well as callousing his fingers. Amazing.
Yeah, but I'm all for that. But I also have to say, George Miller is now in his 70s, and these things, I mean, Mad Max Fury Road took nearly 4 or 5 years to make. And I hope this one doesn't take as long. I hope they don't have the trials and tribulations that accompanied the shooting of Fury Road. Hopefully they won't. Hopefully it's going to be fairly smooth, plain sailing. And also, it may not be that type of movie. We assume, because it's got the Mad Max name attached to it, that it's going to be some sort of road movie, some sort of chase movie.
You think it's going to be like a knockabout sex comedy?
It might be a knockabout sex comedy. There might be a sort of bedroom farce with, you know, Hemsworth and Abdul-Mateen II walking in and out of bedrooms going, whoops, who knows?
I mean, obviously we'd all be there for watching that, but I think not on the whole.
I think not sex farce is where he's going to take this.
Thanks, George. Great pitch. Just a couple of notes. Number one, maybe no sex farce, ?
I don't know. He went that way with Babe, Pig in the City, didn't he? That was a knockabout sex comedy.
I mean... Sorry, I'm just trying to envision the Babe, Pig in the City version of a sequel to Mad Max Fury Road.
That'll do, Pig.
Wow.
Anyway, so yes, very excited to see whatever George Miller does with that. Probably not a knockabout sex comedy, I'm guessing. What else do you guys want to talk about? There was a lot of stuff.
Coming to America is no longer Coming to America. That's quite depressing. Well, I mean, it is, but not in cinemas. Coming to America will instead be coming to Amazon in December, going straight to streaming. And I say boo to that. Boo to you, sir.
But also yay, because more people will get to see it. So, you know, at a time when there are a lot of cinemas closed, and which is obviously horrific and unfortunate, but at least this way people get to see it, I guess, you know.
It's true. I mean, I for one, I'm going to be glad to watch it. I'd rather rather this than it get pushed back to like 2028 or something? I don't know. Like, I'd much rather see it in the cinema, but I will take seeing it over not seeing it, certainly. But it's just, it just feels like yet another nail in the, I don't want to say coffin, but in the hibernation compartment of theatrical exhibition.
Yeah, stasis chamber.
I was very frustrated by this news because I was really looking forward to watching this film in the cinema. But Coming to America, as I said previously, is my favorite comedy of all time.
It's amazing.
And my family have had many a happy time just watching that film, knowing everything that's going to happen, having watched it hundreds of times, like still laughing extremely hard at everything which happens. And I'm just thinking about a screening of, you know, a coming to America double bill that's somewhere like Peckinplex, that would have just bought that house. That, assuming that Coming to America is as good as we all hope it is, that sort of thing would have really bought the house down. So it's frustrating to not to be able to have that experience. I'm just hoping that the film that we do get is still sort of as good as we hope it to be. And I look forward to hopefully many more times with the family just having fun with that film as well.
Yeah. I don't know. I find this all really, really sad.
Yeah,
I really do. And I get the argument that, yes, more people are going to see it. More people are going to see Soul when it opens at Disney Plus on December 25th. And having seen Soul now, I think it's absolutely terrific. But mm-hmm. I also think it's possibly the most uncommercial Disney Pixar movie yet. So this actually might be a smart move, putting it on Disney Plus rather than in cinemas. But I'm sad when I see things like this. I'm sad when I see things like The Witches, which is now not going to get a theatrical release over here. We talked about this a little bit last week, mainly because there are fewer cinemas in which to open it, I guess. So it's going to be on PVOD at the end of the month as well. I get sad about that. I get sad when I see Cherry. You know, it's great that we're all going to get to see these movies, but I want to see them in cinemas, and I want cinemas to stay alive and stay open, but we don't want to go over the ground we went over in great detail last week.
Yeah, exactly. it's tough times. At least films are in production and coming out. We've had a bunch of trailers out this week, which we should talk about in a second, but there is one in production I wanted to mention, which is Adam McKay's Don't Look Up, which has decided to enter the race.
Dogs Don't Look Up.
No, dogs can look up, but this film is Don't Look Up. This is the latest Adam McKay film, and he's clearly, you know, put his marker in the ground and decided to join the race for starriest cast ever, because he already had Jennifer Lawrence and Rob Morgan lined up. This week, he added DiCaprio, Meryl Streep, Kate Blanchett, Jonah Hill, who obviously has Adam McKay form, Himesh Patel, Timothée Chalamet, Ariana Grande, noted physicist Kid Cudi, Matthew Perry, and Tomer Sisley. But yeah, this is a big good people. So basically, DiCaprio and Lawrence are a pair of mid-level scientists who discover that a meteor is going to strike Earth in 6 months. They try to warn the world, and everybody goes, "Oh." If you spot a clever metaphor for the climate crisis, then well done you. It's pretty subtle, but I'm pretty sure it's there.
If it's Return to the Big Short, Adam McKay, but with a little bit of a blending of Anchorman, Step Brothers McKay as well, then I'm absolutely all for it. Mm. Yes, indeed. Big cast. Hella good names.
Yeah.
See, if I was a casting director, I would have cast those people.
Oh my
that's
God,
how good
that's
I am.
Amazing. Wow.
That's how good I am.
Imagine thinking of Meryl Streep for your film. I mean, who does that, you know?
She's the meteor, crazy. In fairness. I have to point that out. She spent several months circling the Earth in preparation for the role.
I did read an amazing description of her, which said she's cast as an actress typecast as an actress who can't be typecast, which I thought was amazing. Ridley Scott's making a Napoleon film with Joaquin Phoenix, and it's for some reason called Kit Bag.
Is it Napoleon the football locker room?
I mean,
years?
Genuinely, I'm a bit taken aback by it. I'm sure it makes sense in some fashion. Oh, it apparently comes from the saying, "There's a general's staff hidden in every soldier's kit bag."
Oh, naturally.
But, sure.
Speaking of films that are going to change their names before they come out.
Yeah, seriously.
It's going to be called Mad Max Kit Bag by the time it comes out. Yeah,
and then also Patty Jenkins is working with Gal Gadot again on a Cleopatra film.
Coming at you.
Indeed.
It is.
Not that Cleopatra.
That was in my head for days. Cleopatra, coming at you.
Cleopatra, coming at you.
Coming at you.
Does anyone know the rest?
No. They don't license the music. They've missed a fucking opportunity.
I don't know about this one. I don't know that we need another Cleopatra movie for a star. I certainly hope that they, you know, take a slightly different look at the character who's been over-sexualized since literally Roman times. It would be cool if they actually gave her some credit.
Yeah, she was quite a sexy character. Didn't she at one point marry two of her own brothers, as I recall? She's quite incesty historically.
You just need some context of, like, history, guys. Jeez. I don't think she married two of her brothers, actually. But anyway.
Are you sure? I think she might have done.
Okay, well, we'll look it up. Yeah. Point being, she's been over-sexualized since literally Roman times. She was actually quite a capable ruler by some accounts and maybe deserves a bit more credit.
Was she the last pharaoh, essentially?
Yeah, I guess maybe. But the point is, it depends how you count it. Again, the point is, there's been a lot of controversy though over this casting, because even though Gal Gadot is from the right part of the world, in that she is from Israel, of course, and even though Cleopatra was at least half Greek because of the whole Ptolemaian thing, there's at least some suggestion that her mother was North African, and that therefore it should be a woman of color. Or more colour playing this role, because certainly Gal Gadot's ancestors, I believe, were European.
And only half of Cleopatra's were.
Indeed.
It's just frustrating in that the uncertainty which Helen speaks of means that Cleopatra, that there's no good reason why she shouldn't be played by women of color. And yet we've had so many interpretations of this character, and every single time it's been a white actress or a white passing actress that's played her. You've got Elizabeth Taylor, Hildegard Neal, Claudette Colbert, Vivian Leigh, and now Gal Gadot. They have cemented what Cleopatra should look like on screen, even though that shouldn't necessarily always be the case. So that's frustrating. And then you sort of, you know, you think about Hollywood's, you know, history of whitewashing, which is not great. It's not going to change unless the people in the positions of power, like a Patty Jenkins, like a Gal Gadot, you know, enforce change and sort of make the decisions to create change. Because otherwise, we are still going to keep sort of getting what we're getting when it comes to these types of movies. And change is on the horizon. You think about historical, sort of recent historical epics like what the personal history of David Copperfield did, and casting Dev Patel as that character. Mm. So this can be done.
But that's
done.
Not a $200 million movie.
I have to say,
This change, I don't think, has to come from Patty Jenkins necessarily. This change has to come from studio bean counters and studio executives who go, this is a $200 million movie, so therefore it has to make $800 million worldwide to break even. Therefore, in our way of thinking, this needs a big name to put bums in seats. Never mind the fact that there are loads of films out there that have made millions upon millions of dollars and have hit it big at the box office without big names, and that there are films out there that can make stars. It's not us that Patty Jenkins has to convince. It's the studio bean counters. And hopefully they will change their mind
about
this.
I just don't think that any of that's true anymore. That's the problem. And I think they know that. I don't think those calculations are true anymore, if they ever were. But I certainly think that they aren't now.
I think it's outdated, outmoded thinking. I really do. Why don't we just cast Andy Serkis and be done with it?
Oh, my God. The Tolkien white men again. Jeez. Oh, yes.
Can open worms everywhere. This parish is a knapsack. Oh, no.
No, I'm interested as well in the Napoleon film, though. Like, I don't think we've sort of discussed that enough. Because Napoleon nearly killed Stanley Kubrick, didn't it? I mean, trying to make a Napoleon film, not Napoleon personally, nearly killed Stanley Kubrick.
That's a headline that I missed.
I mean, that would be a hell of a film, though, wouldn't it? Napoleon stalking Stanley Kubrick. Amazing.
I mean, it wouldn't be difficult. He doesn't leave his house.
But yeah, this is supposed to be a personal look at Napoleon's origins and his swift, ruthless climb to emperor. Now, the swift, ruthless climb to emperor and Joaquin Phoenix, I think, could be great in sort of Commodus mode, which obviously he played for Ridley Scott before. But the origin stuff, I'm a bit less comfortable with, because like I feel like he's past the, you know, 20-year-old école militaire kind of Napoleon stage of his life. And I'm just wondering, do they get somebody else, or do they have him sort of playing Napoleon across 25 years?
Helen. Get that Marvel CGI money.
The only Napoleon film we need to see is Temeraire, and I will hear no more about it.
I will agree with you on that. If you haven't read Temeraire, it's basically the Napoleonic Wars, but with dragons, and it's amazing.
Every historical subject is improved at least 50% by the inclusion of dragons.
That's just science. Wait, could we get some dragons in ancient Egypt?
I don't see
Chris,
why not.
Chris, you're the casting director. Who would you cast?
As a dragon?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd cast us because we make this podcast drag on every single week.
Hey.
Just a couple of other bits and pieces before we talk about some of the trailers that launched in the last week or so. So Ava DuVernay is going to direct a film called Cast, which is interesting.
I haven't read the novel this is based on, which is by Isabel Wilkerson, but it's been critically acclaimed and is apparently fascinating. So I plan to get after that now, because if it's good enough for Ava to start look at adapting, then it's probably one that we should all have a look at.
Tell us about it. What is it? What's happening in this?
All I know is it's a multi-story structure, not in the car park sense, that examines the unspoken system that has shaped America and chronicles how our lives today are defined by a hierarchy of human divisions dating back generations, which I assume refers to racism and white supremacy, to be honest. But I don't know for sure, so I look forward to reading it.
What little I know of cast, Ava DuVernay feels perfect for that story. So I'm intrigued to see what she's going to come up with. I think the last thing she did was When They See Us, which was obviously very, very good and won a ton of awards very deservedly. So I'm happy that she's back in the director's chair.
Should we talk about trailers?
Yes.
Yes.
So there were a few this week. We can probably go through them pretty quickly. Everybody's talking about Jamie. It's the trailer of the musical, or the film version of the musical. Richard E. Grant stars as a drag queen who mentors a young boy, Jamie, of the title, who thinks he wants to be a drag queen as well. I thought the musical was decent, but not incredible, I'll be honest. But this is a very fun trailer in a year that doesn't have a lot of fun. So I think people will enjoy that. Then we also had the trailer for Monster Hunter, which I haven't watched yet because I've been saving it as a treat, honestly. Yeah, is it fun?
That title is so vague. What's it about?
Is it
the Winchesters?
yes, it is. it is a very, very Paul W.S. Anderson movie. It's based on the Monster Hunter games, which is essentially hunting giant mythical monsters, and this is Mila Jovovich as a kind of soldier who gets sucked into an alternate world in a Humvee with her other soldiers and is beset upon by dragons and monsters and things.
Ooh, dragons.
So, yes, exactly.
Sometimes I just want to see some big-ass monsters and some people with some big-ass weapons hunting them down. This seems, and I want to see this on a big-ass screen too, because the trailer already sort of on my little sort of laptop screen looked really, really cool. And watching this movie in IMAX is...
And also, I will say that the giant dragon thing is not the most ridiculous thing that Tony Jaa kicked this week. So if anyone's seen the trailer to the new Nick Cage film, Jiu-Jitsu, is Tony Jaa versus a shit spaceman. That is quite extraordinary.
I'm a man of simple taste. Sometimes I just want to watch a movie in which Nicolas Cage fights an alien space ninja with a sword and martial arts. And that feels like that's what this movie's going to be.
Aliens came to Earth, but they didn't count on jiu-jitsu and Nick Cage.
They didn't count on Nick Cage. His ability to say yes to everything.
It's like Mortal Kombat meets Predator. Love it.
Yeah.
Yes, it's certainly a film that's going to be coming out. There's no question
about
it.
It has the look of one of those just gloriously early 90s straight-to-video type titles. With a spaceman, it's just some shit they threw together with bits of plastic they had lying around the studio. I very much want us to watch it.
Yeah. Monster Hunter looks incredible. Yeah. It looks like the... the film that finally, the worthy follow-up to Event Horizon that has been lurking inside Paul W.S. Anderson all these years. It's going to be off the chain. It's going to be 2 stars, isn't it? It's going to be awful.
Maybe it'll be great.
Maybe it'll be great. Everything's Christmas Eve. And then a couple of other trailers as well. Amon, there was something you wanted to mention.
Yeah, so it was a trailer for Sylvie's Love, starring Tessa Thompson and Nandi Asamuga in a jazz-era romance.
Sounds good.
It looked really, really cool. It's out on Christmas Day on Amazon Prime. I'm always here for more black love stories, and this trailer also gave me La La Land vibes, which I'm sure delights her.
I really like the trailer, and now you've put me off it, so... Great. I had a little bit of almost, if you've ever read the book Sex and the Single Girl, it almost has a little bit of a air of that about it, because it's this, you know, she's a career girl trying to make her way in sort of 1950s, 1960s New York. And it had a little bit of that feel about it. And I really liked that it wasn't just a love story, that it's also a kind of a career story. And I thought that'd be an interesting twist on things. So, I'm really looking forward to that. Plus Tessa Thompson in a romance, it's going to be great.
Yarp, and then the other trailer was Hillbilly Elegy, in which Glenn Close and Amy Adams look directly at the camera during the trailer and say, please give me an Oscar, which I thought was unusual.
Look, it's a bold strategy, but they've been up, 6 and 5 times respectively, and still haven't won.
Well, maybe they should be better. Have they thought about that?
Oh my God. Wow. That is an unsupportable remark.
Maybe you should act more.
Well, they're certainly acting more here, I'll be honest.
They could not act any more than they're acting.
This is the adaptation of the best-selling book by J.D. Vance, chronicling his upbringing, and they play Amy Adams as his mother, Glenn Close as his grandmother, and it's the sort of the family dramas that tie them all together. They do feel like it's a very Oscar-grabby one, and it's kind of a shame because both of them are absolutely... of a caliber of person who deserves an Oscar. Both of them are Oscar underdogs who are well overdue a win. If they win for this, however, I have a feeling that there might be a bit of a almost backlash. You know, they might become, somebody suggested on Twitter that this week that winning for this would make them Oscar villains, which would kind of be a shame. But But yeah, this does look serious and heavy, and I'm sure it will be interesting.
Okay, so that was the news section, and now it is time to delve deep into this week's reviews. And with Halloween just around the corner,
now it's time to review films.
Hello, stop it.
Not me. Stop it. I didn't do it.
Stop it.
I didn't do it.
There are many ways of killing a man depicted in the Friday the 13th movies and indeed the Halloween movies. quick course correction there. Don't make me try them out on you.
Oh, my word. All right. Okay. Anyway, because Halloween is just around the corner, this week's films are mainly horror films. Hooray! Mm-hmm. And we've got ghosts and we've got werewolves and we've got vampires. Oh, my. And we're going to start out with Vampires versus the Bronx, which hit Netflix last week, and I think this is great, but does Helen O'Hara concur?
I more or less concur. I somewhat concur. But this is a cute film. It's from Oz Rodriguez is the director, and it's set in a part of the Bronx where gentrification is sneaking in, and they're beginning to buy up local businesses. They're threatening the local bodega, and three teenagers are trying to raise money to save the bodegas. They're traveling around the neighborhood trying to get people interested in coming to a block party to raise money. And as they go, they begin to suspect that something is amiss. Wouldn't you know it, that there's a company called the Murnau Group who are buying up all of the local buildings as they go. And I don't know if you know, guys, but they're kind of spooky looking and they kind of only come out at night and they don't seem to eat much. Could they
be students?
Shit. Worst threat of all. Yeah, some of them do have long hair as well. Jeez, it's terrifying. So I thought this was actually quite cute. It very much owes something to a little bit to Buffy, a lot to The Lost Boys, like a lot to The Lost Boys. Even the vampire design is very Lost Boys-y, slightly Buffy-y. They've got the sort of, you know, changing faces and stuff. But it has its own spin because it has a very strong sense of place. It has that sense of the Bronx. It has the sense of the people there. You know, it's a working class neighborhood. There is that it's a multi-ethnic neighborhood. There's that sense of, will the police believe us if we go to them? Can we trust the police? Which kind of speaks to racial division and social history in the US. And so that gives it a slightly different feel to just the normal vampire stuff. They all worship Blade once they find out about him, and that is right and proper and as it should be. Exactly. So there's a lot of kind of comedy in this. There's a lot of kind of heart, I think, in its humor. It's not going to be the most terrifying film of the week, I feel set in saying.
That's,
I feel like,
fine,
that's safe
for me.
Enough. Yes, even Amon was okay with this one.
Professional fraidy cat, Amon Woman.
And around the sort of the core kind of trio are Jaden Michael, Jared W. Jones III, and Gregory Diaz IV as our three heroes. But around them, there's a really good supporting cast of more experienced actors. So you've got like Sarah Gadon, Method Man, Shea Whigham, who's always good in everything. A little tiny Zoe Saldana appearance. Really, really good people. And that kind of keeps, I think, probably kept everybody's sort of standards up and everybody's interest high, because these guys were obviously excited to be working alongside some of those people. So, yeah, it's quite charming. It's quite cute. It's not very scary, but it doesn't want to be. So I liked it. I don't think it's going to rewrite the vampire novel history film, but it's cute.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. And when they turned to Blade for advice, the film went up at least another star for me. That was just great. Blade gets more respect in this film than many people in our industry have given it over the last two decades. It's wonderful.
Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate up.
I was waiting for somebody to say that line when they iced the vampire. That was the only thing missing. I was just waiting for it. And there were many opportunities, but nobody did it.
I think they were worried about the rating.
you can have bleeped it out and made it even funnier.
Can't bleep it out.
But yeah, I really enjoyed this. The kids have great chemistry, and they make for really fun heroes to root for as well. It's a little bit on the nose, but I found it very, very charming. And it made me want to rewatch Blade, which is no small thing.
Oh yeah, it must be a day ending, and why?
Mainly because Blade is 1,000 times better than this film. But it is fine. Like, I thought this was okay. I'd have given this 3. Yeah. Ben Travis, lunatic that he is, gave it 4.
No, I can't
imagine why.
I'm absolutely with Ben in this. I thought it was...
I found it gently funny, very far from hilarious. It has entertaining moments. It's just, it's very low rent. I think I like the fact that it's well written and it's clearly self-aware and it knows what it's doing. And it does, you know, it definitely has sort of an eye towards referencing The Lost Boys. In fact, there's a scene almost lifted directly from The Lost Boys in it. I can't help but think that kind of Lost Boys in the Hood was the elevator pitch for this film. But I like, you know, and some lovely moments. There's a death by skateboard moment, the Blade stuff really enjoyed, but largely it just, it felt really kind of hammy and really corny. And bear in mind, I've seen every single episode of Forever Night, so I have quite a high tolerance for shit vampire schlock. But this, you know, it was diverting. Like I say, I'd have given it 3, but I did not.
You are without a heart. You are hollow. Yeah.
I like the fact, you know, it might have been a little on the nose that the company, the construction company was Murnau Productions. Mm-hmm. And there's a little picture, that iconic picture of the etching of Vlad the Impaler on their logo. It's like, yep, guess good. Low-key, like what you're doing there.
The only thing that irritated me is that the kids are on the ball, but the adults, come on, there's so many clues as to what is going on.
But that's classic horror movie fodder, isn't it?
Are.
Like,
they
that's the
are.
Classic formula. Adults don't have a clue when it comes to horror. The kids are the only ones who see it.
Look around you, man. Yeah, look around you. Yeah, I had a blast with this. I'm absolutely on board with this and Ben's 4-star review. I thought it was just terrific. I think it's a better remake of Fright Night than the actual remake of Fright Night. Mm. There's a lot of Fright Night in here as well. There's a lot of Lost Boys, as Helen alluded to earlier on. 4 stars. We gave this one 4 stars for Vampires vs. the Bronx. And
do
seek it out on Netflix if you fancy. Up next is The Wolf of Snow Hollow, which is the eagerly anticipated second film from Jim Cummings, who is a writer, director, star, breakout writer, breakout director, breakout star of last year's wonderful Thunder Road. And this sees him play a fairly similar character. This time he's a small town cop in a very, very snowy town of Snow Hollow, trying to solve a series of murders that may or may not have been perpetrated by a werewolf. A werewolf, you say? How? Oh, no! Amon Warman, you used to be a film critic, but you're all right now? What did you think about this? Tell us about this one.
So yeah, Jim Cummings writes, directs, stars in this film as John Marshall. He's a sort of stressed out police officer who is struggling to contain the paranoia that grips his small mountain when a string of grisly murders happens. It may be the work of a serial killer, and maybe the work of a werewolf. And I had a decent time with this. I really liked Vicky Lindholm as Officer Julie Robertson. She's like the only one besides John Marshall who is competent. This film is also very, very funny. It gets a lot of humor out of Marshall getting mad at his colleagues for being very, very bad at their jobs, which made me laugh quite a bit. And similar to Thunder Road, there's a lot about toxic masculinity in this film, which I think they do a really, really good job of, especially when it comes to what John Marshall is going through, and how sort of his arc develops with his daughter, especially over the course of the film, I think is really, really well done. So yeah, I actually think this is better as a comedy than a horror. It's not really that scary, which again suits me just fine. More films like this, please. So it's a bit of a tonal clash, but it kind of worked for me. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I find Jim Cummings' performance incredibly off-putting, especially in the early scenes. I kind of got into it a little bit more as the film went on and got into this weird tone that they were going for that wasn't, I didn't find it either comic or horrifying, I guess, which is the problem, but it was in between the two, which I maybe wasn't giving it credit for at the opening. And I just found the lines sort of clumsy and clunky in a way that I didn't love as well. So even once I got past the performance issues, I still didn't like the script. And I get, again, I agree with all the stuff about toxic masculinity and uncontrolled rage and all of those things. I thought that was interesting. I just didn't enjoy watching it at all, really.
You could argue that you not liking his performance as a terrible human being is actually a...
No, but I didn't like his performance as a performance of a terrible human being. It's not that I didn't like the character and that was my issue with it. I didn't get that he was a good actor from this at all.
Really? I think he's really good.
Mm. Not in the first half, no.
Okay, interesting.
I should also mention this is, I think, Robert Forster's last role.
It is.
And yeah, it's a fine send off. There's a line reading, which I'm not going to say because it's a bit of a spoiler, but it hits extra hard knowing that Robert Forster is no longer with us. And I found that moment pretty powerful. So yeah.
If you have seen Thunder Road, this is very much in the same ballpark stylistically and tonally. And also the character of John Marshall is fairly similar to the character that Jim Cummings played mm-hmm. in Thunder Road as well, but just with this potentially, possibly supernatural murder mystery breaking out all around him. So he's completely out of his depth. He's got these rage issues. He's an alcoholic. He's lashing out at everybody and everything. He's a terrible, terrible human being. And at certain points, the movie is, I think, trying to push your endurance levels. Like, how much can you invest in this guy who is making fuck-ups and mistakes at every possible opportunity? But I think the last 25 minutes or so brings it round very, very nicely. I think he displays a very interesting evolution as a director from Thunder Road, which was a lot of fixed camera shots, a lot of closed off camera shots as well. There's a bit more, he does a bit more stylistically here as well. It's more expensive than Thunder Road. It looks more ambitious than Thunder Road. It's an interesting one because I don't know how much this is going to please horror hounds. And the comedy, I mean, as Helen said, the comedy is very dark. I liked it, not as much as Thunder Road, but it is, I think, if you're into that movie, if you're into werewolves, if you're into very, very pitch black comedy, then it's definitely worth a look. It's on PVOD right now. And last, in the scary films stakes, we have the reunion of David Koepp and Kevin Bacon. As discussed earlier on, this is You Should Have Left, in which Kevin Bacon goes to Wales. Which is very difficult to do these days.
Yes, that's the scariest part about this film. No, this is indeed, as you said, the sort of a spiritual follow-up to Stir of Echoes. This stars Kevin Bacon as Theo, who is a retired banker married to Susanna, a successful actress, some 30 years his junior, which is kind of, which initially you might not bat an eyelid at because this is a Hollywood film, but actually does serve a point in this plot. Their relationship is going through some difficulties, I think. So they take their young daughter Ella and go away to the what can only be described as the most lavish Airbnb I've ever seen. There's a lot going on in this, so I won't get into spoiler territory, but Kevin Bacon's past is shall we say interesting, in that his wife is famous and he is perhaps known as infamous, and so he tends to keep his identity as secret as he can. And when they get to the house, so it's a haunted house kind of set up ish but it's really kind of probing. There's a lot of subtext here about insecurity and masculinity and aging and, you know, the massive sort of like sort of neuroses he has over having this much younger wife. But it's got some elements of The Shining to it. I'm trying desperately to tiptoe around the plot. So there's some elements of The Shining to it in terms of this is part sort of supernatural thriller and part one man's nervous breakdown. Yeah. I found it really interesting and I actually really enjoyed it, partly because I really like the three central performances. Bacon is great, Seyfried is good, but honestly, Avery Essex, who plays their daughter Ella, one of the most naturalistic child performances I've seen in a very, very long time. I thought she was fantastic. I will say there are a lot of, shall we say, very familiar, well-worn horror tropes in this. The nightmares, sort of waking up from a dream trope, is very overused. But it is suspenseful. It's atmospheric. I think they use the house architecture very well because it's kind of a slightly interesting modernist horror house. And some good use of reflections for some of the horror in there. There's a lot of third act weirdness to look forward to, which we can't really get into at this point.
Yes.
You know, it blurs the lines between fantasy and reality. It's had a bit of a kicking elsewhere. I enjoyed this a lot more than I thought it would. It's no Stir of Echoes. It doesn't work quite on that level. But I think it's good enough. I thought this was fun. I enjoyed it more than The Vampires in the Bronx.
Oh, no, I disagree with that.
Vampires versus the Bronx is a lot easier to recount the plot of.
It is.
Than this, as you just proved.
But this is a film whereby to recount the plot is problematic because you have to avoid recounting the plot.
Yeah. I enjoyed Vampires versus the Bronx more than this, but I did think that this was decent. The more the themes of the film began to reveal themselves, the more interesting this film got. I think Bacon, especially in the latter half of the movie, really sort of puts in a great performance. I'm also not going to say too much more because I don't want to spoil it. But yeah, I thought it was decent and not too scary, which is a win for Amon.
I have to say that's a really interesting point, because none of the films we talked about this week, they're all horrors per se. That's where you'd find them if you had a blockbuster left and you went in and they'd be in the horror section, right? But none of them are particularly scary, and I think that's intentional. He's not that sort of director, and it's not that sort of film, and it is a character study of this man who is, you know, he's besieged by the ghost of his past in a way, trying desperately to retain some sort of equilibrium. And that's not very jump scary, I have to say. Vampires vs. the Bronx is a PG. There is an F word. So it's a PG-13 movie. There's barely any scares in that. And The Wolf of Snow Hollow is the most terrifying thing in that is Jim Cummings and his rants, his alcohol-fueled rants, I would say, even more than the wolf thing going around killing people. So this is a weird. I don't think any of these movies are certainly elevated horror. You certainly couldn't call Vampires vs. the Bronx elevated horror, but there does seem to be a weird reluctance to embrace
gore,
scaring people, and gore. Yeah, definitely gore. Vampires vs. the Bronx will not satisfy gore hounds. That is for sure.
I mean, even Wolf of Snow Hollow. You know, it's clear gory things have happened. They are discussed, but they are in no way shown. Which, you know, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it's definitely a thing.
Absolutely. So I don't really know what we're saying here, apart from the fact that don't go into these expecting to peek at all three films through your fingers. But I think all three films have merits, certainly. And don't expect having that gorehound part of you sated in any way, shape or form either. But yeah, I like this film. I thought it was anchored by a tremendous performance by Kevin Bacon. And Amanda Seyfried is also very, very impressive indeed as his wife. So 3 stars then for both You Should Have Left and The Wolf of Snow Hollow. Very, very quickly, we have another film out this week, which isn't a horror film, but may be the scariest film of the week because basically the spoiler alert, everyone dies. It's I Am Greta, which is a documentary about Greta Thunberg, the schoolgirl who's trying to save the world and a bunch of dickheads are trying to stop her.
Yeah, and this is a film that they started shooting basically when she started her campaign. Like, the filmmaker has been following her since she was on her own outside the Swedish parliament on her school strike, and has followed her all the way up through, you know, talking to the UN and going around the world and talking to world leaders. This guy, Nathan Grossman, has been with Greta and her family, in particular her dad. So it's very intimate. It's very up close. You literally see her and her dad, you know, packing the car for long trips, and her having a meltdown because she doesn't want to, you know, stop working on a speech and actually have some much needed rest before a big day. And you get the sense of her as a person, a sense of her as a teenager, a sense of her as a neurodiverse person on the autistic spectrum. You also see how completely ridiculous it is for American Republicans to suggest that her parents are manipulating her in any way. This is clearly something that comes from her and that her parents certainly support, but in no way push on her. And you see the toll it takes because it is incredibly, incredibly difficult. I think what's missing from this film is a bit more of the context and a bit more of the wider perspective on what she's doing and a bit more analysis of why the fuck the world won't listen and why nothing is happening. And that's what's really frustrating and really, really scary about this film, is that they're all essentially patting her on the head and saying she's wonderful and saying how important what she's doing is and saying, isn't she great? And then ignoring her and going back to business as usual, and really we as a reality, as a planet, cannot afford to do that, and that is what we are doing anyway. And it has to start with, you know, I mean, we can all cut down on freaking plastic straws and eat less meat, and it's not going to do the job. We need governments to act, and we need to force our governments to act. And right now, they're not listening to us or her. Yeah, this is really tough. Actually, I think I think it's a. As a documentary, it's a bit, you know, limited, as I said, and I think a bit lacking in oversight, but it is a very good look at her as a person. So I think we gave this 3 stars.
We did indeed. 3 stars for I Am Greta. That makes Vampires vs. the Bronx this week's Film of the Week. Hooray! When we remembered to do Film of the Week. We've done it this week. So therefore, well done, Vampires vs. the Bronx. James is practically agog with happiness at that. He is. He's furious. Coldly
furious.
Sit
upon a throne of lies. Smell of beef and cheese.
Indeed. Anyway, on that bombshell, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Olivia Cooke, star of the Irish gangster comedy drama Pixie. Very exciting indeed. But until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye of my three colleagues of such lethal cunning, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Amon Worman.
Peace.
And that other fella, James Dyer.
Disgruntled grunt. That's what you get from me.
What's different from your other musings on the podcast? They're all disgruntled grunts, Jimbo. They're all disgruntled grunts. And of course, it is goodbye for me. I'm off to bypass cinemas and head directly to streaming. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200 million. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week. Bye.